This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine. Good afternoon.
Hi, on this rainy, rainy day.
Rainy, rainy day. Catherine, you pitched this morning and I held off asking you, how did you go?
It was good. It was really good. It was really fun. So this is the adaptable pitching program through the Queensland Writers Centre. We were all meant to fly up to the sunny Gold Coast, be there, meet people in person. I think we were meant to have, you know, a dinner or drinks and bits and pieces at the end. Ended up being the Zoom version, and it was sort of delayed and, you know, bits and pieces. But it finally happened this morning, and it was cool.
So what did you have to do? Tell us. Break it down.
We had 15-minute meetings. Well, I had three 15-minute meetings with three different producers. I think they were producers from three different TV or film companies, one of which makes the show Bluey.
What?
Have you watched? Bluey is so good.
Bluey is even just a mix person, everything. Did you fangirl? No, you wouldn't have because you're very professional.
Well, I was so like in my own head about what I sort of was focused on and what I was going to say. But it was really good. So definitely got better at the pitch as time went on, only because I reckon the first time round you're so married to the script. And Queensland Writer Centre, through this program, you do a couple of practice pitches with them and they give you feedback and this bits and pieces. So you sort of hone, okay, I'm going to do this, talk about this, then I'll talk about this. But the first one, I was definitely just, this is my pitch, just listen. Like, do you know what I mean?
Whereas I think you practiced it.
Yeah, exactly. And as time goes on, you sort of realise you can be a bit conversational.
So without getting into specifics, what types of things did you drop out by the third time, or what things did you flesh out? Or
I guess you're more, well, one, you're more relaxed and it's more conversational anyway. Yep. So I think you pivot a bit more off an interaction and take it down that line, even though I was going to talk about that third or that kind of thing. I think you get much more into the gist and the vibe.
Yeah.
And so talking about it much less of this person's like this and these are the things that happen to them, and more like they start the book or the story like this and they end like this. So it's much more the way in which the arc of the character in terms
that's
of how
really
that's
interesting
evolved.
Because I suppose if you're flipping it over to how you would do your book pitches, that's kind of that difference between a 10-page synopsis and a 1-page, you know, like where you get room to move.
Yeah.
So what are Queensland?
The helpline, like I would talk about when I talked about character arcs, when I got better at it, I was like much more she starts off lonely and ambitious and ends up less lonely, less ambitious. Like that kind of were sort of the terms that I was talking in. But the people were really, really nice. Like they were actually very easy people to talk to, so I felt very lucky.
And so you're in a position where people are interested in hearing your pitch anyway. You've been selected to pitch.
Yeah, sort of been vetted, exactly. So it's probably a bit easier than ones where you're like the literary speed dating type ones where it's a bit more of a everyone turns up and, you know.
So
I feel like they could have like a buzzer though. I mean, in that literary speed dating thing.
Where they say you're done.
Well, yeah, like it's a bit like a date. Where,
so
you know, if like, well, I think with a date or when you meet up with someone, say you've met them out and you meet them for the next time, you know, in an instant, don't you think? Like, it's a no. It's a no for me.
Yeah.
Like they almost need like a.
It's like a put almost, me out of my misery buzzer.
Yeah. Like just a sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Just vanish.
So I want to ask, because you've, as opposed to me, who basically has to ask you all the time to send me copies of your pitches and synopses, etc., because you had hard copy and you are a skilled public speaker and you've been taught that and you've had this adaptable stuff.
Yep.
What does a good pitch involve through all your wisdom that you now have?
I actually think less programs. I think you hone the pitch the 1,000 times someone asks you what your book's about. That's when you hone a pitch, because that's the point at which you're like, this person doesn't know. A, it gets you in the groove of having to talk about something, but also you can just see immediately as someone's eyes glaze over, and you can see what brings them back in as well. Like, I really think that when you're starting out and someone asks you what your book is about, you sort of fumble and are embarrassed and sort of say how complicated it is. It's really complicated.
So
it's
many
like
times.
Girl. It's just really like that kind of thing. But I reckon that's the art, is to take each one of those and test the...
Which maybe means we need to be telling a bunch of people before we hit that bit where you've got to talk about it all the time. And maybe before you pitch to an agent, if you're unpublished and you're sending this out into the world for the first time, you need to have told anyone who will listen what your book is about again and again and again. I totally agree. I have got the pitch for Skylarking nailed now.
Yeah.
4 years after the date.
But I you also fumbled. Would have had it pretty good then, because you pitched it to Black Ink, like to Aviva.
Yeah, and we've talked about this, and I fumbled my way through it entirely. I had no idea, and because I'd never had to do a synopsis or any of that stuff for it, I didn't know. And then the other complicating factor with that one was that because we changed during the editing process that you didn't know. Originally, you knew that there was a death, like right in the first, and really specifically who killed who in the first line. And then we changed it to be a reveal. And so that really changed the way that I pitched that forever.
Of
course. But I think also that you, like me, with my one at the moment, what are we, 4 months off publication? Time has lost all meaning now. I do not have it down.
Certain things are easier to pitch.
Yeah.
Like something that is, you know, this is about a competition.
Yeah.
It's very, like, it is so much easier. Whereas the helpline, I could pitch it now, but that's only now.
Yeah.
You know, throughout that process, that was much more difficult. But I do think some things conceptually are just, you know.
Harder.
Like Kate Grenville's novel, you know, it's.
Yes.
What's her name? MacArthur in It's an Imagined Diary.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that sort of stuff is just very easy to explain, I suppose.
Yeah. I took a risk and emailed my gorgeous agent, Pippa Masson at Curtis Brown, to say, can you just look back at my first pitch email?
And, did you?
Yeah. And I said, look, I want to talk about this on the podcast, and I would really like to know, because I've never really asked you, because it would have been awkward at the start. Like,
so I'm doing it by email.
Yeah. What was, you know, like what stood out? Why did you request, or, you know, why did you read those first four chapters? And when I looked, just after I'd been reading all this stuff on pitching, and it was like, definitely spell check and have no typos. And I looked at the email, typo, first line. I was like, oh my goodness, I can't even believe. Like, I angsted over that email for weeks before I sent it. Anyway, so she got back to me and she said she didn't notice the typo, so that was good. She said there were three things. That I came via a client recommendation, which is always really helpful. So one of her clients, another writer, recommended me, so that was great and helpful, all of you writers out there making writer friends. Two, she said I had a clear idea of what the book was about, and I had good comp titles, comparative titles, and three, that I gave a short potted history of my career, including the platforms that I was on, which was very helpful. So, like, I thought, okay, well, that's not the stuff that, I mean, they're all things that you hear, and if you read, and agents, the best thing is, because I think agents are so inundated by pitches all the time, they're really quite out there about, in their FAQs and on their websites, about saying, this is what we want, and this is how you should present it to us. So they give a lot of advice. So it's worth reading all that stuff. But I thought that was really interesting. And I don't know about you, like, I angsted over comparative titles for mine for ages, because saying what your comparative titles are, it's risky.
It is risky. And it's always very flattering too, isn't it? At the same, like,
well, exactly.
I am, you know, Graham Simsion.
Exactly. Like, yeah, this is a little bit Jane Harper and a little bit, you know, Charlotte Wood. Like, what? Really? I can't say that. But yeah. So I think that that is worth people really thinking about and not.
The comparison titles is important though. It really does set the context for the book. Because like, it's a really quick shorthand to accompany a, it's about this broadly and it's this kind of vibe.
Yeah. I think it's also, I didn't realize how many, like, people always say you've got to have your synopsis, you know, like 1 to 2 page synopsis, and you've got to have your chapters, you know, your sample chapter, which has got to be shit hot. So get it really well done. And then you've got to kind of have the back of the book pitch, you know, that 2 kind of paragraph pitch-ish. And then you've got to have your log line or your one line pitch. And not everyone will ask for all of those things, but I think it's really useful to have all those things in your head. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think it's different if you've sold the book.
Yeah.
Like if you've got a 2 book and it's the second book, then for some people a synopsis is a hugely valuable exercise for that individual as a writer.
Yeah.
I don't know if I – and I think if I was an editor, I would probably never read a synopsis.
Yeah, that's so true.
I don't think that would interest me overly much.
Yeah, and they're terribly difficult to write.
Well, they're terribly difficult. I think they're terribly difficult to read too, just because they're like, who is this? What?
Yep.
What? Like, it's such a quick sort of bang, 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 bang. This is kind of what happens.
Yeah.
But I think for pitching, you know, the formats that people want are always, you know, for this one it's 100 words, for this one it's 200. So you definitely get better at picking out the points that are the most
true.
Interesting.
Have you ever heard a pitch where you were like, oh, that's so good, I wish I'd done that?
I don't know if I've heard a pitch. There's definitely books that get you, like, have you at the word go. I remember Sarah Schmitz, reading an article on Sarah Schmitz, See What I Have Done, and I could not buy that book fast enough. Like, just was. And, in fact, the book wasn't for sale when I read the article on it, which, I mean, we've talked about that they try
that
and keep
that is unfortunate. She should have had a pre-order link in there. We know this now.
Yeah, exactly. But I was so, like, it just was such, and that was probably more about the fact that the story that she had about discovering the story was so compelling that, you know, she had found this pamphlet and, you know, it was sort of all these strange elements to it. But that was very compelling. But have you?
I want to say one that I only heard this week. And again, it's, I suppose it's kind of like that, the premise of it in terms of what you hear. I think this was on either, I always get the Bookshelf and the Book Show confused. And I'm so sorry, ABC RN and Kate Evans and Cassie McCullough and Claire Nichols, that I get you all confused. But it was on one of those shows. So it was Laura Jean McKay's The Animals in That Country, which is just out and I'm desperate to read. And the, you know, the pitch that you pull up straight away kind of on Google when you look at that book is, as disturbing news arrives of a pandemic sweeping the country, Jean realises this is no ordinary flu. Its chief symptom is that its victims begin to understand the language of animals, first mammals, then birds and insects too. And obviously timely right now.
Mm. But I wonder if it was always in those terms of pandemic and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
I guess it'd have to be. That's a pretty
good
specific
question. But I was like, oh, yeah, same. I want
it's good.
Like, I want to read that right now. That's an easy, high concept premise.
Yeah.
I want to read it right now.
Yeah.
I like that. I noticed too, then it's got, then what a publisher does is puts that other line.
Oh, it's like the tagline.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So hers is out on the road, no one speaks, everything talks. And
oh, that's good.
Which is great. But also I wouldn't want anyone to get confused with the idea that that's the kind of line that they pitch at a dinner party, because I think there's that thing too, you know?
Yeah, I know.
People are like, oh, this would be a great tagline for your book. And you're like, yeah, but – and someone asks you, what's your book about? And you're like, oh, all I've got is the frigging tagline in my head and I can't think. It's really hard to get the right
tone.
Well, you
need both. You need the thing about the vibe and then you need the thing about the what it actually is, don't
That's
you? Because
exactly.
I remember also pitching to people and saying, oh, it's like this meets this, which is sort of useful, but they were like, but what is it actually about?
Yeah. And different for your non-writing friends and your writing friends and the media and someone you want, you know, all those things as well. Okay. Lessons to take away from here. Just practice the hell out of it a lot. practiced that pitch.
Yep.
Catherine, when do we hear about your...
I know, I was just thinking that as well. So I have to send some stuff out today, which is the point that I really wish the thing was finished. I don't know if I've mentioned that on the podcast, that my book's not coming out till next year.
So it's okay. There's a lot of books in that situation.
There are.
Catherine, you're in good company.
But I said to Kanye, oh, they, you know, I've got to send it out. And he was like, oh, not really finished, though.
Thanks, Kanye. Thanks for your support.
Thanks. So anyway.
The whole thing or just samples?
The whole thing.
Oh, mate, that's so exciting.
So I can get used to refreshing my email some more.
Here's to refreshing your email, my friend.
Click.
Click.
Nick Earls is the author of 20 books, including the best-selling novels Zigzag Street, Bachelor Kisses, Perfect Skin, and World of Chickens. His work, which is both literary and commercial, I should say, has been published internationally in English and in translation and has won awards in the UK and Australia. So, Nick, we are taking a bit of a different approach today, and it's an approach that you actually invented in 2018 for a program called The Green Room. Do you mind talking, before we start, a little bit about what The Green Room was and how it worked?
Yes. So in late 2017, Radio National approached a few writers who had made sort of semi-regular appearances on various book-related shows and asked if we had any ideas of our own for shows. And I kind of had this in the back of my mind for a while, and I thought of doing it on my own blog, but then I thought maybe I should save this up for a site that people might actually go to. So rather, I felt that the offer to an author to answer some questions to appear on my blog and be read by a handful of people might not be compelling, but then
misleading us, because your blog is very good, having delved into it.
Sure, but it's a well-kept secret. Not intentionally, it's neglected. There are maybe 200 people who have subscribed to it, and round about every year and a half, I give them something to read for nothing. So it's not I should be blogging more, but I never will. So I just accept that. And now I blog if there's a reason to, or something that's not just way too big for a tweet, but also too big for a Facebook post, then I think, okay, I'm going to put it on the blog. But it's a very untended blog. But then Radio National, that's a different kettle of fish entirely. So people might actually pay attention, I thought, if I offer this to Radio National. So the idea behind it was that if you're an author who's had quite a few books out, who's done quite a lot of festivals and quite a bit of touring, chances are you faced some of the same questions literally hundreds of times, if not more than that. And yet when authors get together in things like Writers Festival green rooms, what we talk about never includes those questions. And I thought that kind of disparity was worth exploring. I thought, what do we actually talk about in green rooms that are, I mean, obviously a lot of the chat's not related to business at all, but what do we talk about that's related to business and that people would actually find really interesting to listen to, but that in interviews we don't tend to get asked? And so I put together a bunch of questions, I think about 10 questions, and the deal was that I would send them out to the author beforehand. And the author, because it was all about, I wanted to create interesting content, the author would then get to choose half of them that where they had an interesting story to tell and something that the world hadn't heard a million times before. And then we'd record it. And that podcast is still around for people to listen to.
It's fabulous. And we will link in the show notes today. So I have sent you your questions and a few of my own questions, and you have picked 7 questions.
Yes.
Are you excited or nervous or?
A bit of both, which is good.
Good, perfect. All right, so we will get started. First question, as writers, we always hope that we'll send a book into a world that is universally, the book is universally loved. Of course, that doesn't ever happen. Can we talk about your most crushing review?
Yes, we can. And it was crushing, Crushing for two reasons. One, because it was just fundamentally crushing, but the other was because of the circumstances. So this was in my very early days as a published author, 1992, Brisbane Writers Festival, and my first book had just been published. That was a collection of short stories called Passion, which pretty much only my mother bought, and critics generally did not favour. So, but this was my chance to make my debut as a published author at the Brisbane Writers Festival, so I was very excited about that. And then when the Writers Festival told me what they had me lined up for, I got less excited and slightly petulant. So I had thought, since I was having a book published, that I would be put on stage with the Booker Prize winners and all that because I was a published author now. But what they said they'd lined me up for was a panel called The Young Ones, and it was kind of emerging writers and their stories, and it was me and a 19-year-old uni student poet and someone who had just started writing for Street Press. And I thought, but I'm supposed to be on a panel with David Malouf and Peter Carey. Do you not understand?
You know who I am.
Exactly. So I responded to that in a way that turned out to be quite fitting with the topic. I had a bit of a tantrum and I decided to do the whole panel. I wrote a very sarcastic panel piece about being included in the Young Ones thing and decided to deliver it in my school uniform. Now, I was at that stage a 28-year-old suburban GP in Brisbane. So it had been more than a decade since the school uniform had been my thing anyway. So maybe they were completely right to marginalise me with the youth if I was going to have a childhood tantrum over it. So then on the day of the session, I started to kind of have doubts once I put my school uniform on. And, you know, however much I polished the prefix badge,
I cannot imagine why you would be having doubts about this.
Yes.
So clearly a brilliant concept.
Yeah, because like such a good choice. But I thought, no, I'm committed to this now. I've just got to do it. It's all I've got is the school uniform and the sarcastic piece I've written to go with it. And I got in my car and I headed towards the Writers' Festival. And I wasn't feeling confident. But then I thought, I've heard that maybe today Passion, my book, will be reviewed in The Australian. So maybe I'll pick up a copy of The Australian on the way and get a bit of a confidence boost. Yeah, you can see how badly this is going, can't you? It gets worse. So I pulled over at a servo and I bought a copy of The Australian and sat there and then just kind of flicked through, quickly got there and thought, yes, my book's reviewed. And there was like even a photo of the cover that was like size. I thought, this is awesome. And then I read the review and it remains one of the worst reviews I've ever got in my life. It said, we often say too many books are published. Rarely are we prepared to name the books. Passion would be on my list. Nick Earls's publisher's claim that he is a rising star in Australian fiction is to be flatly contradicted. So
that's word for word, you can still quote it.
I can. It's never going to leave me. But it's, you know, it spurred me into action, I can tell you. But that day, there I was in my school uniform with that review thinking, how do I now deliver my festival piece? And I drove on towards the festival and I just said to myself, it's the first session on a Saturday morning. Nobody will be there. It'll be your own secret. It'll be fine. It's horrible. You got the review, but it'll be fine. Just push through. There'll be only three people there. So as I got close to the festival, it was pretty hard for me to get a car park, and I parked some distance away and then got to the festival and then realised why it was so hard for me to get a car park, and that was that about 300 or 400 people were coming to the session.
No.
Yeah, this was not my plan. And I was then walking in slightly, like just pushing the time limit because I'd had to park so far away. I was then walking through the crowd in my school uniform, feeling like quite a dickhead, while they all looked at me and thought, what's up with this guy? And then when I got past them and got into the auditorium, that's when I discovered that the sponsor for that session at the festival was The Australian, and they were promoting their sponsorship by leaving a free copy of the paper on every seat. So then I went and sat on the stage and watched as close to 400 people came in. Each of them picked up their free copy of The Australian and thought, oh, look at this, bonus. What are we going to read first? We're at the Writers' Festival. Let's look at the books pages. And then I'd watch them. And I'd watch them get to the page. They'd look at me with this smile on their face. Then they'd look down at the review, look at me. And then they'd look at the review and they'd kind of go ashen. And then they'd turn and look out the window at the river, kind of hoping that my life would get better for me. Yeah. That was pretty memorable.
That constitutes a real low point.
It really does. It really does. It was such a low point that just a couple of months later, I monetized that low point when someone asked me to write an article about it. It had become such a famously bad moment. So, yeah, but I survived. And, you know, 26 books later, here I still am.
Was it hard to go back to writing after that, or you just sort of brushed yourself off and kept going?
There's no easy brushing yourself off after that if you're like a human. It wasn't easy, but I think I was already in the process of having my next thing rejected by the same publisher anyway. So it's no surprise that there was a 4-year interval between the publication of Passion and my next book. A couple of things crashed and burned along the way, but eventually I worked out how to write in a way that some publishers were prepared to publish and some people were prepared to read, and that made a difference.
Well, that's a great start. The only way is up, I think, from there, really.
It couldn't get much worse than that. Yeah. That's what I told myself. That's what my mum told me.
It's probably also pretty tough for authors, especially debuts that have books coming out right now, can play a pretty strange role in the life of the author. Have there been any instances of luck that have impacted on you?
Yeah, so I do think this is a very interesting time for an author to have a book out, particularly if it's, say, your first book and you want to have an impact and you've watched those festival bookings drop out of your diary, though some are going virtual, which I think is a good thing. I hope there's a lot of reading going on at the moment. I hope that will give people with new books some kind of chance, because we can now, of course, get exposed to all kinds of content without leaving our home screens. So it's not quite the same as it once was, which is good. What I've noticed in the last week or so is every day I've heard from people on social media who are reading old books of mine from their bookshelves at home. And I think maybe people have a bit more time at home and they're walking past their bookshelves a bit more, and they think, maybe I'll read some old favourite. So I think the publishing industry is hoping that people will be buying books, but the sense I'm getting at the moment is that people are rereading some old favourites and kind of transporting themselves back to a slightly better time. But I did have the unfortunate experience of being adversely affected by another major world event almost 20 years ago. Worked very hard to get published in the US, and my first book out there was Perfect Skin, published by St. Martin's Press, and everything was lined up for that to be pretty exciting. I had writers' festivals in Canada. I had some events to do in New York, and then the book was published on the 10th of September 2001.
Oh.
Yeah, and I can even remember seeing footage of the World Trade Center, of one of the World Trade Center buildings with its kind of collapsed basement, and seeing that there was a bookstore there. I'm pretty sure I can remember this, in one of them. And at the entrance to the bookstore was collapsed, but the entrance to the bookstore, there was this pile of ash-covered books. And I just thought that I recognized the size and shape and that. And I think that's my book there, just covered in ash. Written off. But, you know, in the context of what was happening in the world at the time, an author having their US career truncated somewhat really didn't have much to complain about, considering what had happened. But I guess I was also...
Still crushing, though, isn't it?
It was pretty dispiriting. And I also knew the implications that it would have. I knew that what would happen down the... That book reviews were pulled for weeks, so it got very little review coverage, because anything that hadn't already come out, they didn't run book reviews for weeks. So there were reviews that were spiked that never saw the light of day, and no one talked about books. And I got to do the festivals in Canada, which was a great experience. But still, everyone was preoccupied with world events, of course. And when the time came to do the paperback edition, I just knew that the publishing company will be looking at the figures, and they go, well, the hardback edition didn't work out, and the author is never going to get any leeway over their pub date and the bad luck they suffered. So it was already not a successful book because it had vanished because of world events.
So, I mean, things feel so life and death in those moments. You sort of think that's it for the US, I'll never be published there again. But that didn't happen, did it?
No, because I had a two-book deal, so they had to publish me again. So I did get published again by them, and I did have a couple of young adult novels published in America. So I think I've had four books published by large publishers in America and quite a few published by an indie ebook publisher in Pittsburgh. But the young adult books being published in America was nice because they've been read in schools for quite a few years over there. So there are schools in the Chicago area where from which I'll occasionally get emails because the students have to read a book that is not American. And then when they do a presentation on the book, they do a kind of thing where you bring a plate and it has to be food that's from the country of your book. So I'll hear from the school students going, what can I make for Australian food? Because I'm just reading 48 Shades of Brown or After Summer, as After January is there. And so I've got them to make, because it's got to be something simple and they can share. So I've got them to make Anzac biscuits, which I explained to them they are not legally allowed to call Anzac cookies, which they kind of like that, the angle that there's an Australian law that means you have to call them biscuits and it has to be made according to a certain recipe. And the other one that I send them is Lamingtons, since the original Lamington was made at Old Government House in Brisbane in the late 19th century. One time when I did this, I got sent a photo of their platter of Lamingtons, and they made all the Lamingtons postage stamp size with a little Australian flag sticking out of them.
Oh, how nice is that?
Yeah.
And fiddly.
Fiddly is anything. Like the ratio of coating to yesterday's cake in those Lamingtons was extremely high. But, you know, there's something to be said for the bite-sized Lamington.
That's true. None of them actually count, do they? They're sort of all so small, it's not like you had anything.
That's right. That's right, just a taste.
Now, Nick, your work is, I would say, at the more commercial end of the continuum. Did you ever feel inferior to more literary writers?
The first part of that is also interesting, that you're observing that my work's at the more commercial end of the continuum.
I was even going to preface that with something. The reason I said that is because it, on, I think it's Wikipedia, it classifies it as popular fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is because I've written 27 books now, and they cover a spectrum, and some of them are more literary than others, and some of them were definitely more popular than others. And what happens is, if you write some books that are very accessible and at the commercial end of the spectrum, and might sell 100,000 copies or so in Australia, and then you write some books that are literary, I might win you an award or two, but that only a handful of people buy, no one notices that you've actually done that because most people out there have read four or five of your 27 books, and they've read the four or five that sold quite a few. And so...
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's...
I should also add, I mean, part of the reason I am asking you this question is that it is a total projection. My work is at the more commercial end of the continuum, obviously not with the sales that you've got. But I know I personally feel that sort of sense of inferiority to more literary writers.
Yeah. But. So I think, and I've had times, there were times when, well, nearly 20 years ago, when I put out my more commercially successful books and spent time with a range of authors who were very commercially successful, and sometimes they'd complain about how they were kind of looked down on. And I'd sit there thinking, yes, but look how rich you are. That's not bad. And I've also had the same sort of conversation with a number of authors who are really highly credentialed and successful authors of middle grade and young adult fiction. And a number of times I've been at school-based writers' festivals with them, and they've been complaining about the neglect they feel from the literary establishment, and that there's a focus on a particular kind of book that's privileged above others. And I've said to them, yeah, but almost everyone I know who writes those kinds of books actually does it on the side and does something else to earn money, whereas you get to do this as a job because you've got big sales in schools and you've got schools wanting to pay you money to turn up and do things. So there's a pretty, you get something pretty good back for that, for that snubbing that you're feeling. So, and I think what there are, you know, there's a bunch of different genres out there that we can identify and that publishers publish into and market into. And there are readers that cluster around those genres. And some of them do very well commercially. And so literary fiction is kind of the genre that you have left when you've named all the other genres and people are writing books about characters rather than about action and not expecting to sell many. So really, in terms of inferiority or superiority, how I guess I came to terms with that was I think each time I write a book, what am I trying to achieve with this book? And have I achieved it? And does reader feedback suggest I've got there? So if people read a book of mine like Zigzag Street and tell me they laughed uproariously and they read it every few years and it's one of their favorite books, that's great. That's a great connection with that book, and that's all I need. I don't need people coming to me and talking through all the subtext of that. If people find subtext in that book and it connects with them in a different way, that's great too. But I think each time I set out to write a book, there's a puzzle I'm trying to solve. There's a challenge I'm setting myself, and I'd rather measure myself against that than myself against my perhaps misperception of how people might be judging me and where the book fits into the marketplace. I'm really grateful that I wrote some books that quite a few people bought and that turned into plays and a couple turned into films, because that was really advantageous to me. But I'm also grateful that I now have the freedom to explore what I want to and try to kind of test myself and push myself and see what I can do. Early this century, when I was putting out a book a year and a healthy number of people were buying them, there was more pressure to come up with the next book in that genre that those people would buy. So it was kind of having that then has an impact on the publisher's bottom line. And I've now managed to slide to a level where I don't have an impact on the publisher's bottom line, and I'm calling that freedom.
That's a really good way to think about it. What is your favourite book that you wrote? Where did you think you realised that vision of what you wanted to do the most?
Now that's the question I'm interested in, that bit there. So it's very hard to pick a favourite for me because each book, kind of in terms of just thinking of favourites, not the final thing you asked, which I will answer separately. So if I think about, people often ask me about favourites, they're much less likely to ask me the thing that you asked about the book that came closest to realising what I set out to do, which is of rather more interest to me. When it comes to favourites, for me, the book doesn't end up as the book. It's what went on before to make it happen, and all the planning and the writing and the editing and then the publishing and the reading and the response from people. So it becomes an experience. So I kind of have a relationship with each book rather than, I don't even kind of know them as books anymore because I don't go back and read them. But if I think of the work that I've done where I feel I came closest to living up to the benchmarks I set myself, that would be so far the Wisdom Tree novella series from 2016. I had clear ideas of what I wanted to do with that, And I felt like I got closer than I had got before to achieving that. And the response from other people fitted with that too. So that'd be it.
I haven't checked out the novella series, but you...
This is the position I'm in, is that there are quite a few people who will have read some of my earlier novels and far fewer people who will have read those novellas. But that's the thing that I've long ago relaxed about and decided to accept, because, you know, I had reasons to write those. Novellas were never likely to outsell my early novels, but if I'm going to write something, then I've got to throw everything at it and make it the best it can be. And I think I got close with that. So, yes, it was a really rewarding thing to write.
Did you do your PhD around the Wisdom Tree novella series? Were they interlinked?
Yes. So they started out as individual ideas, but at the suggestion of one of my principal PhD supervisor and the person who ended up being the print publisher of the novellas, I did link them. And at first, when they said that, the idea struck me as somewhat nauseating, because I thought this could be me setting out to write the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants here, where things are kind of linked by something that feels cheesy to me as a concept. But then I thought maybe there are ways. And I set myself some ground rules, and it was, anytime I'm going to come up with a link, does it add to what I'm doing? Does it not detract from what I'm doing? And does it avoid being cheesy? And if it could do that, then I was open to it. And then I discovered that I could do some things that I found really interesting and was quite enthusiastic about. So ultimately, I certainly embraced the idea. But at the same time, I wanted the novellas to work independently if people just picked up one. So each one needs to work as its own thing. But if you read all five, you'll get glimpses of characters from different points of view and maybe different versions of the story. And that's a kind of interesting add-on.
Nick, you've also, in addition to all this writing, fronted a major tourism campaign. Did it make you more recognisable? I'm referring to the Brisbane.
Yes.
Only done one. The Brisbane tourism campaign.
The Brisbane marketing campaigns of, what, I think 2002 and 2004.
Which are available online, and I will link in show notes. Good. Did you have a hand in the writing of them?
Yes.
Yeah, they're really good. They're very fun.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, there were certain things that I had to achieve in them, but I was also, I did say, because they approached me about being the face of the campaign, and I said, I have to say yes to this, because Brisbane choosing a writer as the face of its campaign instead of a Brisbane Bronco or a Brisbane Lion is just such an exciting thing, then I've got to say yes. But since you're choosing a writer for the campaign, do you think I could also be a writer on the campaign? So I did get to have some, I did get to be involved in writing the ads, which was great. And it did, so there's a bit at the end of the first ad where there's a security guard, I think, who I'm telling a story about a guy meeting a girl, and she's from another place, and she's a backpacker in Brisbane. It's his home city, and he uses the virtues of his home city to strike up a relationship with her. And then at the end, there's a security guard behind me who goes, "But how does it end?" And then I go, "Does it have to end?" as a very dodgy green cocktail, which refers back to stories of mine in Head Games and World of Chickens, a dodgy green cocktail slides into shot. And so for several years after that campaign, when I was out in public places, dodgy green cocktails would be presented to me by someone who'd noticed me across the room. So I'm glad that phase is over now. I was never a fan of the creme de menthe frappe that I kept ending up with. But it took me back to some unfortunate uni student experiences. But it was a good thing to do. But there are, of course, times when it's not ideal when you're recognised in public. It's kind of odd if you're in a public place and, say, a 14 or 15-year-old girl runs up to you, grabs you, puts her arms around you, gets her photo out and takes a selfie. And you just got to think, I'm a male now in my 50s. I need to manage this awkward situation. They want the selfie with me because they've seen me and they've read my books and stuff. And their parents are currently perplexed, wondering, why did you grab that man who's as old as me? And I'm having to go, I didn't start this. I'm cool with the photo. I write books. Perhaps your daughter's read them. And then we're all okay. So that can be a little awkward. Probably the more awkward thing than that, though, was the time when I went to the movies, and I went to the toilet, and there I was in the male toilet at the trough for the last time, and the guy next to me just happened to recognize me out of the corner of his eye. And so in saying, hey, aren't you Nick Earls, he swiveled around. And he didn't just swivel his head, because men are crap at that. He swiveled his whole body around and urinated all over my shoes. And so now ever since then I use the cubicles. So yeah, there's a downside.
There's a huge downside. Okay, we are on to your, this is great. I'm going to do this approach with everyone, I think. I suspect people won't have as good stories as you, though, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, see, the thing is, you never know. Until what the great thing is, I think, that a lot of authors have got stories in them, but the cue for telling them hasn't come along. So, yes, let them out, I reckon.
Which is a good segue into the next question. Your most awkward interview moment or experience in front of a live audience?
Yes, okay. For me, that has to be November 2001. So I'd just come back from those Canadian writers' festivals that I went to with Perfect Skin, and the short trip to New York for no events, but to just show solidarity to my publishers while Manhattan was still burning. And that was a freaky sight when I flew in, I can tell you. Then after that, at that time, so I had a book published in Australia called World of Chickens in November that year. That's the book I came back to Australia to promote. And World of Chickens was the kind of last in a run of books that were intended to be kind of laugh out loud comedies about the lives of hapless young men. And it centres around a med student in Brisbane in the 80s who works at a fast food outlet selling takeaway chicken. So that's what I was coming back to Australia to promote, a book that was definitely a comedy. But before I came back to Australia, after I'd been in North America, at that time, I'd just become the founding chair of the international aid agency War Child in Australia. And so we'd funded things using some fundraising anthologies set up by Jessica Adams and a few other people. And these anthologies ended up raising $3 million for War Child and doing an awful lot of good in a whole range of countries. And so after my trip to America, I visited Kosovo, where there had been a war a year or so before, to see some of the projects that War Child was funding in Kosovo. Then I came home and started my book tour with my latest comic novel. So my own head was reasonably scrambled at that time, but it turns out I was not alone in that. So in that tour, I went to 2GB to do an interview. And this was when Kerri-Ann Kennelly was on 2GB rather than on TV at that time. And you know, we met a couple of times before. So she was interviewing me that day. And I turned up at the studio. I was the first interview of her show that day. And she was running slightly late. So instead of the chat beforehand, like we were coming straight out of the news. I was the first guest out of the 10 o'clock news. So I was there 20 minutes, 20 to 10, half an hour before I was likely to be interviewed, ready for the pre-interview chat with Kerri-Ann that you would have just to get everything sort of centered. But Kerri-Ann wasn't there at the time. She was running late. And so I was wheeled into the studio as the news went on. Kerri-Ann still nowhere to be seen. And then as the news was going, with like a minute to go, Kerri-Ann surged into the studio in her immaculate Kerri-Ann sense, as always. There she was, all ready to go, but going, I'm sorry, I'm so late. And then she sat down, and we came out of the news with no chat at all. And then she said, Nick Earls is my first guest in the studio today. And then she looked up at me and she had notes in front of her that she hadn't had the chance to look at properly yet, but she noticed something in the notes. And she then said to me, Nick Earls, I'm sure our listeners, she's looking at me with the serious Kerri-Ann face. What's going on here? And she said, Nick Earls, I'm sure our listeners would be fascinated to learn what it's been like being a surgeon in so many war zones.
And what was that like?
Well, Okay, so that was, so there was a bit of a pause then, which I filled with my usual desperate pause filler. That's a really interesting question, Kerri-Anne. But then went on to say, because you'd be right in thinking that even though I've only worked as a doctor in Australia, my medical experience in Australia was particularly valuable when I was looking at some of the projects War Child had funded in Kosovo last week. And Kerri-Anne looked at me. She totally worked it out in a flash and she mouthed, I'm sorry. And then took us off down a much safer track. Oh, so we worked it out. We got through it. But there was it was a challenging moment because, you know, you can't claim to be a war surgeon if you were just a GP in suburban Brisbane.
Not even out of politeness, can you?
Not even out of politeness, exactly. I can allow a whole lot of dodgy CV information to pass uncorrected out of politeness, but, you know, there are limits.
Okay, so it said that at least one author prefers his Mars bars peeled. From all that you've heard, from all those you've heard, what's your favourite example of author diva behaviour?
Oh, look, this is good because this is one, this certainly comes up in green room conversation quite a bit because we all want to not be the biggest diva and we all feel better if we've got stories about bigger divas that we can share. And I did get a few of those when I was doing the Green Room podcast, but still my favourite one is one I heard a few years ago about an author who is no longer with us, but was a very highly regarded literary author. I think he had a knighthood, might have had a Nobel Prize, not completely sure of that, but nonetheless, very, very highly regarded literary author, who turned up to a particular writers' festival in Australia. And because he was the big, big literary star of that writers' festival, he got kind of the presidential suite in a great hotel. And the rest of the authors were getting the regular suites and feeling happy enough about that because, you know, someone was paying for them to be in a hotel and they were getting a $70 per diem. Not this guy, though. He and his wife turned up to the presidential suite at this hotel and discovered there was a pillow menu. And this was in the very early days of pillow menus. They'd never seen a pillow menu before. And I think it went to their heads a bit. So they ordered all the pillows so that they could try them all out. And all the pillows were brought to their room. And the problem was that that then made them really critical about pillows. And when they tried all the pillows on the pillow menu, they found that they didn't actually like any of them. So if there'd been no pillow menu, there would have been no problem. But the pillow menu provoked this close scrutiny of the pillows and all the pillows were found wanting. So then the very famous author, highly regarded author, phoned the director of the festival and presented this conundrum, wow. Said, I'm in my hotel room. I've tried all the pillows on the pillow menu, but I don't really like any of them. And the festival director, being an Australian, wanted to kind of slightly take the piss at that and said, look, I'm really sorry to hear that. Would you like me to bring a couple from home? And he said, yes. So she had to drive from her house with two of her own pillows.
Oh, my God.
Which he then found satisfactory. And because he found them satisfactory, when he left this Australian city on to the next festival in New Zealand, he took the pillows with him.
That is the best example of good behaviour.
Yeah.
I hope he still has those pillows.
Well, maybe now that he, I believe, is deceased, maybe his widow is seeking some solace from the excellent pillows provided by that Writers' Festival director.
I don't know. I don't reckon people replace their pillows that often. I feel like you'd be better off with the pillow menu.
I think so, yes. the whole thing's ludicrous, isn't it?
We are on to our final question, Nick. What is the most ludicrous contract clause you've ever been asked to agree to, and did you end up agreeing to it?
So I've got a couple that I find particularly ludicrous that I did agree to. One has come up two times. It's been to do with film contracts that are when people want to adapt my novels. And when you sign, you know, you sign a book contract and the territory might be Australia and New Zealand and a few other places, or it might be world rights, for example. But two-time film rights, I have been, and I have agreed to sign up rights throughout the universe.
Wow.
And now think about that. Throughout the universe film rights. So that's not just people making it into a movie on Earth. It's like if someone wanted to make it into a movie on another planet, they wouldn't be allowed to, because that would somehow be a problem for these people and their film project. It's not even throughout the galaxy. It's throughout the universe. And if you do the maths, if you kept it to the galaxy, just sold galaxy rights, and someone in the next galaxy wanted to make it, here's how it goes. The next galaxy is Canis Major Dwarf, which is 25,000 light years away, which means that if you transmitted your work that they were then going to adapt in the film industry of Canis Major Dwarf, it would take 25,000 years to get there and then probably a year to make it, to do the adaptation and get it all finished, and then 25,000 years to send it back to Earth, which means you've got 50,001 years of safety to exploit the rights before you get the remake from Canis Major Dwarf. So wow. It's utterly nonsensical selling film rights throughout the universe. So, but I'm always happy to do that because I love a, you know, filmmaker has got that great an ambition, give it to them, I reckon.
And you probably get a bigger advance for the universe, right?
Wouldn't that'd be good, wouldn't it? Yes. I sell this per galaxy, you know, but I'll give you a discount. After the first 1,000 galaxies, you can have them for 50% of the usual price. Yeah, that would be good. I should get more. I should apply more leverage there. The one that I've agreed to with Book Contracts is the very amusing Schedule B of little tiny places that my publisher wants to include as part of the Australian rights package. For example, the McDonald and Heard Islands.
Wow.
Do you know much about them?
No.
You sell many books there?
Not yet.
Not yet. And do you know why?
Why?
It's inhabited and humans aren't allowed to go there.
Oh, wow.
They are volcanic. It's Australia's only active volcano. It's McDonald Island, and Heard Island is right next to it. And they are a biosanctuary, so that there is one visit made per year by an official ship with people clad in like COVID-19 compliant gear that they then wear onto the island and that they then and is destroyed when they come off. So it is a biosanctuary. There are seals there, but until seals develop the capacity to read, I don't think publishers actually need to buy the McDonald and Heard Islands territory. So I repeatedly sell territories to publishers which are unoccupied. There's one exception, though. There's the Coral Sea Islands territory, where on Willis Island there is a weather station with either 3 or 4 meteorologists. I don't know that my publishers actively market to them or if one of the meteorologists doubles as a bookseller, but there are humans there. It's also known as the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the South Sea Islands, having been annexed as such and proclaimed as a kingdom with King Nigel as the king in about 2012. They have issued stamps, but I don't think they sell books. So
is King Nigel also a meteorologist?
I don't think so. He lives at West End in Brisbane, apparently.
Oh, okay.
And I think he might have relinquished his claim to the throne now that that marriage laws have changed in Australia. I think that was the main point of the Gay and Lesbian Kingdom of the South Sea Islands, was to create a place where marriage was simply between two adults. And now that Australia has caught up with the GLK, the GLK, I think, has been willing to merge once again with Australia.
Wow. Well, that's a good news story, isn't it?
But a happy note, among all these territorial debates.
We are going to leave it there. Nick Earls, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun to talk about these things that I don't usually get to talk about.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.